All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like, oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back, guys, to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off, broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. Now, of course, you could probably notice from the background behind me that I'm not in my normal underground bunker because some hurricane was passing through today and all kinds of issues getting prepared for that. So I'm in a temporary location for this broadcast, which you might recognize as my old studio. I am Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, running, former candidate for president of the United States, currently running for governor of Texas. And today I've got a very special guest, Tavarish Agarist. I hope I said that right. A follower from Sweden reached out and he wanted to have an interesting debate, which, I see all the time within libertarian circles, but I think it's really a great discussion to have, whether or not libertarians should be running for office to work for the government, which we hate. But before we get started, I want to take a quick minute to ask for your support. So of course, head on over to taxationistheft.info. Help yourself to hats and t-shirts and flags and all kinds of other cool swag that we've got over there. Everything that you do goes to support my campaign for governor of Texas. It goes to support us distributing our counter propaganda around the world and eliminating taxes and government oppression for everybody. So please help us with your support. And now, on to the show. Tavarish, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So, wait a second. Say something?
Yeah, I'm from Sweden.
Okay, hang on. My, I gotta fix the audio here. Sorry, technical difficulties, guys. All right, try now.
Yeah, I'm from Sweden.
Okay, almost. Now you're going to the live stream, but I can't hear you. So let me just give me one more. Oh, I know why. All right, say something else.
Hi.
There we go.
What's up?
All right, damn tornadoes screwed everything up, but here we go.
Yeah.
All right, welcome. How's it going?
Hey, it's quite good. Awesome. I just had a test yesterday on history. It went quite well.
Nice.
So I'm quite happy about that.
Awesome. Well, so I just want to fill everybody in. You're actually in Sweden right now, so it's late for you, which is why we're doing this this live stream a little bit earlier than normal. But hopefully it looks like everybody's tuning in. Otherwise, this will be on it'll be recorded, so you can watch again later tonight at the normal time. But awesome. So yeah, welcome to the show. And let's start with this. You had an interesting proposition for a topic of debate. Let's start with that. Why don't you talk about what your position is?
Yes. I think it's more appropriate to start at the very grandstand of my philosophy, which I do borrow from. I believe his name was Plato. He had a theory of reaching knowledge. He basically said that you reach knowledge through dialectics, which is thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. In simpler terms, that would be that you have idea one, and then you have idea two, and you smash them together. And then you either the better idea wins, the one that is most true, or you get a completely new idea or a mix of them. So that's how I reached the knowledge. And I believe that in philosophy, you do have to be objective, which means that you can reach truths in philosophy and you have to reason with logic. And in the philosophical debates, it is required that you have a common definition of several words. And if you don't do if you don't have that, you and I say a word and we both have different understandings of what it means, we can't really have a productive discussion. So I propose that we grant definitions as objectively as we can in history. So we basically look at the first usage of the word and use that as the definition. An exception to this would be if someone built up on the world and expanded upon it. And this is okay as long as it's consistent with the original definition. An example would be like the usage of the definition of the word capitalism. Capitalism was starting to be used in the 1830s something, 1840s, I believe. And one of the first usage of it was basically ruled by capitalists, or the existence of the private capital, or the control of the economy by the private sector, basically. And so a lot of people who call themselves libertarian and liberals really hate what I'm going to say next, but the one who expanded on the word was Karl Marx and several other communist philosophers. So I believe it's their definition we should use. So how do we define libertarianism objectively? Well, the first usage of the word was in 1789. It was by a philosopher called William Belcher from Britain. And he basically said that libertarianism is free will. It was a philosophy opposed to the determinism or nihilism of the Christian Church. And it's a portmanteau word of liberty and unity, or from the fertile, which is libertarian, or the Latin, which is libertas, or freedom. So all of these, libertarianism, recognize of free will. So I've got the general outline of argument. It's my main argument. So only agents have free will. An agent is basically someone who can alter the material world, someone who can do moral and immoral things. That free will is an agent's ability to make choices without interference from superior agents, such as God and some God. I am an atheist because I do believe that the God claim cannot be proven, and it hasn't been proven. So, to have free will and to have agency in general, agents require self-ownership. An agent, by definition, must own herself and vice versa. So therefore, we can safely conclude that self-ownership is the first principle of libertarianism. First principles are, as the name somewhat implies, the first principles from which secondary principles are derived. So, would you agree on that?
Yeah, well, there's on which part? There's a lot there. Let me respond to some of that. So, I completely agree on your position about definitions. That, you know, if people are having a conversation and they don't share a similar definition, it's a senseless conversation. And this is actually something I talk about a lot. The problem that I see with, you know, using, as much as this might be a logical reason, or, you know, a logical method to figure out which definition should be used, ultimately, it doesn't matter which definition you use. If we're attempting to have conversations with the public, because as I like to say, you can't, unless the public comes to a consensus about, you know, what type of, you know, what freedom looks like, what society should look like, and how we should treat each other. Unless we come to that consensus, we're never going to go anywhere. And to have conversations with these people who all have different definitions in their head of what things mean, like you mentioned capitalism or libertarianism, is extremely difficult, because you can't, you know, first of all, you always have limited airtime. So as soon as you get on TV or you get on a podcast or anywhere else and you start speaking about certain things, we need to do this, we need to fix this, we need to reintroduce capitalism, or we need to, you know, socialism, or, you know, all these other words that are out there, which are very, very complicated words, which are understood by everybody as different things. You don't always have the opportunity to explain which definition you're using ahead of time. And people often don't have the time to listen, even if you did have the time to explain it. So we're also dealing with, you know, yes, we can sit down and have a conversation and we can agree on definitions for certain words. We can even use definitions temporarily. We can say, for the sake of this conversation, capitalism means this. And we'll say, and we'll forget about our other definitions, and that'll be fine. But that doesn't really work in public discourse, because most people aren't interested in having that whole conversation. And we're still dealing with, this is a rational conversation, a philosophical conversation that we're going to have, versus what the public wants to have, which is a purely emotional conversation. Whereas, you know, oh, they understand that billionaires are evil and they get rich by stealing from people, and that's what capitalism is. As soon as you mention the word capitalism, and especially if you're wearing a suit, they say, oh, that's one of those evil capitalists, and I'm not going to listen to a word that he says, because, you know, whatever he tries to tell me about capitalism and how it doesn't mean what I think it means, that's evil propaganda, and I just don't want to listen to it. So, which is an irrational position for somebody to hold, but at the same time, that's the reality of what we deal with. So you're very right in a lot of your premise, but there's also this very interesting sort of, you know, we have to deal with the reality of the real world and how it's chaotic, and each person individually is different. Other than that, you're absolutely right as far as on a logical base, about having the same proper definitions. And to your point about capitalism, you're absolutely right there. A lot of people hold those definitions. They you know, they think capitalism is bad because it means rich people are ruling over you, which I don't agree. I never really agreed with that as the definition of capitalism, but because I understand people use that definition, I just say, okay, I'm not going to use that word, because I don't have the time to sit down and have that conversation with everybody. Okay, let's iron out what our definition of this word is. And some people don't even want to temporarily accept a different definition. They just want to say, oh, well, that's not what capitalism is, and you're wrong. So it's much easier to have an effective conversation with somebody on morality by just not using those words in the first place. They're like trigger words, right? So if you just avoid them, you'll be able to actually get further in the conversation. So that's one thing that I've learned with that. I think that responded to everything, to all the points I had.
Yeah, that was actually just half. But yeah, I do see your point. And the only response I could make to such a scenario would be to ignore all of words and just use in this current world or in this hypothetical world. To just avoid using the old words, and
right,
you remove all the bias with them.
Right.
But in the philosophical and the intellectual, I believe that it is the Platonic dialectic which is superior. So, yeah.
Sure.
So I was talking about the first principles. Yeah.
Yeah.
First principles. Are those principles from which secondary principles are derived. So we have established that self-ownership is a first principle of libertarianism. So from that principle, we can argue for principles such as the zero aggression principle, the zero aggression principle, commonly called the non-aggression principle, but is heavily associated by so-called anarcho-capitalism. The right to life, liberty, and property, a concept such as morality and rights in general. So I would conclude that morality is a philosophical analysis of our world. Its axioms are philosophical truths discovered through dialectics, and its first principle is self-ownership. Yeah, that was what I had the creativity to write.
Right. Yeah, I think I think that's very true. That self-ownership. Well, it's interesting. Because you have, yes, self-ownership is kind of the basis for this, but you have also, you talked about free will and where does that come from? Or rights. Why do you have the right to self-ownership? For example, let's say you create a machine, you own that machine, but what if you create a machine with intelligence and it becomes intelligent and it wants to claim its own rights. It wants to claim its own self-ownership. At what point does it have a higher right to own itself than you do as its creator? We see, people own animals. They treat animals like property. What right does a person have to treat another? It's another being. It's a different species. It has a different level of intelligence. Some people might argue some people actually have some animals might have more intelligence than some humans. But what is it that we're able to say, oh, this thing, this being over here is able to have self-ownership, but this being over here is not? And I think that's a really interesting question, but it's a lot of people will say, oh, well, it's obvious. Or because they're human, but because they're human isn't really a good argument. Because they're obvious is it's not really an argument at all. It's really because I said so. It's a defense of I have nothing further to say. It's just obvious, which is really more an emotional response to say, well, that's the way I want it to be. So there's no further logical argument to that. So I think that's really interesting. And I've tried to come up with, how could you mathematically prove something like that, where where if I want to have self-ownership and you want to own me, like at what point, like obviously you would want to have self-ownership and at the same time you want to own me, so at what point can we say, well, look, if we're going to agree, if we're going to see each other as equals, then we can't have that, because that would also mean that I have the right to treat you like my property. And so if we zero things out and make things equal, obviously if you're my property, you can't be your own property. And if we were to even things out, then you would just see that everyone has self-ownership. But then you bring into the equation the entities who we believe don't have self-ownership. And then the question is, well, why not? Is it simply because they don't have the ability to say, I own myself and I am free and I'm an individual? If I weren't able to say that, if you came along to me and you said, hey, you're my property now, and I just said, okay, I guess that makes sense. I mean, you said it and therefore it must be true. And then I did everything that you said, I would now be your property, not because you did anything to me to, coerce me or manipulate me or force me to be your property, but because I simply didn't have the insight to say, no, I am my own property. So do some of our rights, our right to own ourselves, of self-ownership, do they come from our own desire and our own proclamation that we own ourselves? And do we have to first say that first? And I think that's really interesting, because when we look at the political atmosphere that we have, so many people are willing to submit to the government because they don't acknowledge their own self-ownership. And that I think is it's an interesting thing, because then when they see us as equals, you have two people sitting next to each other, and let's say they both agree, yeah, we're equals, we should treat each other like equals, but one person believes in self-ownership and the other person does not, then what do you have? You have one person saying, hey, I'm okay with leaving you alone. That's the person who believes in self-ownership. But then the other person who believes that we're equals says that the person who owns himself should not own themselves, and the government should tell them what to do. But they also believe that that is equality, because they themselves don't believe that they own themselves already. So I think those are some interesting perspectives, and going down this road, I think there's not really anything concrete or absolute, because as some people say, morality is invented by humans. Morality is not scientific, and it's not, I mean, there's philosophy where you can debate it, and you can come up with logical arguments to arrive at certain conclusions. But as you go back to the original premise has to be true in order for a logical argument to follow. And what's the original premise? What's the original factual statement that all humans should have self-ownership? There really isn't any, unless it's solely derived from a person's own ability to say, I want to own myself.
That's certainly interesting. So I think I should start at how do we come to the conclusion of self-ownership? And that is, if you're not a complete absurdist, you would acknowledge the first fact, which is, one, you exist. And then you would look at, you exist inside of a body, inside of the human framework. Which is basically our surroundings, our cultures, our ideas, our history. And you do have to accept that framework to operate inside it. Otherwise, there is no point in having a discussion. So, going back to the original point, that you are inside of your body and you're operating it, and you're having these thoughts, and no one else are hearing this voice, so you are completely alone with yourself. And I think that it counts as the homesteading of yourself. Your consciousness is inside of your body, therefore, and no other consciousness can be inside of your body, therefore, that body belongs to that consciousness. And we can again come to conclusions of truth claims about rights and principles through the dialectic. So if I claim I have a right or just a claim to your body in any kind of way, or the produce of your body, then I have to prove it. And all of those arguments cannot uphold. They are going to be fallacious. So it's like, until the God claim can be proven, everyone should be an atheist. Until I can prove that I have a right to your body while you don't to mine, then I simply don't. And I would argue that rights are a legitimate claim to something. So you divide rights into positive and negative rights, and positive and negative in philosophy has nothing to do with the mainstream definition, as most people would think. Positive in this case means action, and negative means inaction. So the right to life is a negative right, since you don't need anyone else to have life. But if you would say, I have a right to food, that would classify as a positive right since you need someone else to provide that food for you. And because of the consistency law, the law of consistency, or the principle of consistency, you have to apply your principle of consistency in order for them to be principles at all. So if I don't own myself, who does? If someone else owns me, why do they have that claim? Why do I not own them? That's an inconsistent claim. If society owns me, I would simply say that society doesn't have agency. It is a made-up term to refer to a group of individuals, which do have agency. If you would say that an individual, like a king, owns us, and we're the serfs, the king would have to demonstrate that, and he's not possible to. Historically, kings have appealed to God, which they couldn't prove either. So I would argue that rights are a constant. They don't change. They don't disappear. They are not created. But these legitimate claims are rather discovered. So I've heard people say that rights are like privileges. They are granted. And so you have to demand rights in order to have them. But that's inconsistent as well. You cannot have a right today and then have it disappear tomorrow. That would be like saying the day-night cycle is going to be true for today, but it is going to be true tomorrow. So we do have to be consistent with that principle as well. And therefore, I would claim that rights, these claims to something, is objective. And when it comes to morality, I would argue that morality, what you have to prove, just like with my argument for self-ownership, I have to prove that something is immoral for it to count as immoral. And I would say that violations of these rights, those legitimate claims, is immoral. I've seen a good example from a channel named Back Alley Philosophy for why you have to prove that something is immoral in order for it to count as immoral. He proposed the statement, it is immoral to wear blue underwear that is red on Tuesdays. So the first problem is that there is no such thing as blue underwear that is red. So it becomes completely arbitrary. And what makes it immoral to wear it on Thursdays, but okay, just 1 minute after midnight? So you also have this term, which is positive claim and negative claim. So, for example, theism, Christianity, would be a positive claim, where they claim that God exists, so they have to prove it. While atheism basically says there is no God, it cannot be proven that he exists, and until he is, atheism is true. And so goes with morality and self-ownership. And coming to your last point, I'm not really sure if machines would classify as agents. I am quite divided on it. I am quite anti-technology. I am quite scared, frankly, of having artificial intelligence. But as it stands now, I would say that they might have self-ownership. The problem with the machines is that they basically deterministic in nature because of the code. The code predicts everything, basically. So they don't really have true free will as we experience it. But I would rather argue just if it is true that machines do have self-censorship, if they have some kind of consciousness, it is better to not create them at all.
Okay.
Just skip the risk.
So, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, when it comes to living beings, I'm not sure either. You could argue that sapient or conscious beings can exercise self-ownership, and that beings like bugs are deterministic and therefore don't have self-ownership. But I'm not sure. I don't believe I'm knowledgeable enough of biology or psychology to reach a conclusion.
Well, I mean, a simple example for that might be dogs, because people treat dogs commonly as property. And, you know, is there, at what point are you able to, because let's say the dog says, hey, I want to own myself. He can't communicate that in those words. So is it possible that he's trying to communicate that and there's just no way because of his, you know, his biology doesn't allow him to use that type of language, or maybe he uses some type of sign language that we don't understand and therefore we ignore it. Which also brings up an interesting point. What do you do about a person who's in a coma? Do they have self-ownership because they can't say, well, I own myself? And why would that even come up? Well, if you come in and say, hey, I want to unplug this person, right? You want to pull the plug. And the person, like a normal person, would say, no, don't do that. I own myself and you don't have the right, right? So somebody is going to claim the right to pull the plug and somebody else is going to object to it, right? And we see this like in common law, where generally things are accepted as fact if they are not if nobody objects to those facts, which is I think kind of interesting that in that that's how rights can be seen also. So if somebody says, hey, I want to take you and make you a slave, and if you don't say no to that, if you don't resist that to any degree, and you just say, oh yeah, I'll go along with that, then that doesn't, and I like to use rights as the term, as are you right to do it or are you wrong to do it? It doesn't necessarily make somebody wrong to do that, to take a person and turn them into a slave, if the person who's becoming that does not in any way object to it. And I think arguably that's what we have today in the society, where we have so many people that are slaves to government and politics, simply because they just, whatever the kings say, they just go along with it. They just say, okay, that's fine. And it's debatable whether or not that's wrong for these tyrants to tell somebody, and for these, you know, knowing that these people are going to mindlessly follow. What we do know for a fact is wrong is when they tell someone like us, someone who agree with self-ownership, that we have to do something and we object to it, and then they violate our rights with the use of force and violence. I think that's a much more clear distinction. To your point about rights, like, it's very true, right? Your rights don't, you know, just if you have a right today, they can't just go, they can't not be your rights tomorrow just because some king changed some legislation or, you know, made some declaration or anything. That doesn't change your rights. But what's interesting about that is it's the same thing. You still have to declare what those rights are. And this discovery process that you talk about, I think has a lot to do with as a society, people have to, for one thing, if they don't consider rights at all, like up until just a couple decades ago, nobody really considered the rights for gay people to get married. Was it always their right? Yeah, absolutely. But if society didn't recognize that right, then society would prevent them from doing that. And they'd not only prevent them from doing it, they would think that they were right to prevent that. So did that actually change anybody's rights when gay marriage became legal? Which, of course, that's arguably another thing. Is it the government's authority, or is it the government's right to say who can and can't get married? at all. And I think we'd probably agree that, that no, the government shouldn't be in that business at all. If people want to make a contract between each other, they should, anybody should be able to do whatever they want. But if society believes, if the majority of society believes, it is our right to prevent people from doing something that we don't think is right, then what that means is this person might have that right. They might be right to do this thing, but it also means that they have a world full of people who are willing to probably use force and violence to prevent them from exercising that right. And so while it is their right, they still have to fight for that right to actually do it and to prevent people from obstructing that right and to get people generally to understand and accept that right. Not that they should have to. And I think that's like a, that's a big, that becomes kind of an emotional circus when people say, I shouldn't have to fight for this. Yeah, you shouldn't have to, but that's just the reality of the world. You can't, unfortunately, you can't just wave a magic wand and say, okay, all of my rights are going to be understood by everybody else, because either they don't want those same rights or they don't need those same rights. And so therefore they don't understand and they've never considered those rights. And to ask them to acknowledge something, when, especially when they have, some sort of like a voting power, to influence whether or not the government, another agent, will allow you to exercise those rights. I think that's where it becomes very difficult, because people who, you know, most people will say, oh yeah, I'm not really that interested in politics. And they're not interested in like all the minutiae of like all these millions of different possible scenarios. But because of that, because they're given that power to decide what is right and what is wrong based on their legislation, but also they are themselves wanting to remain willfully ignorant of how it affects everybody else, we're giving an unjust power to a group of people who are unknowingly violating other people's rights by delegating that authority to a state or to a government. I feel like I'm really going on a tangent with this one, but yeah, I think it's, you know, we can have philosophical arguments in a vacuum and that's great, but then taking them into the real world, it's completely different, because you have to deal with emotions and everything else. So I think that's where things kind of get muddy. So I guess, you know, to sum this all up, you're very right in the things that you say, but it's unfortunate that the practical application is very different, and that's just because of the flawed human mind, I think.
Yeah, that is truly a very hard problem we do face in our society. I'm going to start with the cell phone stocks. So, a average dog has about the same intelligence as the average 5-year-old, if I remember that correctly. So I think we should treat dogs like we treat 5-year-olds. They are not really capable of understanding logical concepts, philosophical concepts as we are. So we shouldn't really blame them. So if a dog murders someone, is not really the same thing as if a person murders something because dogs do not have the same capacity to reason or understand something. So, but dogs do, in a way, form voluntary agreements with humans. They agree to be part of the family in exchange for protection. So to some degree, I think it is voluntary. And I do object to the use of the word property when it comes to animals. I do not believe that that the family that has that is taking care of the dog has any property claim to it. A more accurate term would be a claim to protect my short-term memory is kind of bad. I'm tired, so I don't know if I responded in full to your statement.
No, I think those are they're interesting questions, or they're interesting points. And certainly, I mean, yes, arguably, if a 40-year-old person murdered somebody, it could be argued, oh well, he wasn't intelligent enough, and so or it was he was mentally insane. All these arguments could be made, and of course those are the same arguments that when somebody's 16 or 17 and they're going to be tried as an adult for a murder, those are the same arguments that they'll make, is that but they had the mental capacity of an adult, and so therefore they should be tried as an adult. But I think what's ultimately interesting about that is that doesn't change the fact that somebody was killed, and what's usually determined, the whole point of having this trial is not to just be able to label this person as a murderer. You're a murderer now. That's it. That's the end of the trial. No, it's to find out what do we do with this person to prevent them from doing further harm to society, to prevent them from killing somebody else. With dogs, usually what they say is, oh, well, we're going to have to put the dog down because this is a violent dog who has a tendency to kill people. With the mentally insane, they say, okay, we're going to put you in a prison, but it's a prison with doctors. With somebody who intentionally murdered somebody, they put them in a prison for punishment, or arguably to remove them from society so they won't continue doing further harm. But of course, in the case of a person murdering his wife, it's not like he's going around getting married so he can murder wives. That's probably not something that's going to recur. That could have just been a fight, or somebody who murdered their business partner over some sort of dispute. It's not like that's going to happen over and over again, and yet we still associate prison time with that. So I think to that point, that's where we look at things as individuals and say, like whether it's a human or a dog, we look at that individual and say, okay, what should the consequences for this wrongful act be? But to your point about so you don't see animals as property, which is great, but that doesn't mean other people don't see animals as property. And to your point before too, just because you see rights and somebody else doesn't see rights doesn't mean that those rights don't exist. But in general, yes, there is some sort of voluntary agreement between a dog and a human where, there's that protection. However, at the same time, there's no concrete terms. There's no very hard agreement, which means, let's say the dog's in a yard with a fence. Yes, he's being fed every day, but he's still trapped within the fence and he wants to go outside of the fence. He wants to run around. He wants to do all these things, but he can't because the fence is there. Or maybe he's chained to a pole, which I think most people agree that that's wrong to leave a dog chained to a pole all day. But even the fence, does the dog have the right to go beyond the fence? And yes, you're offering him protection because you don't want him to run into the street and get run over. But to what degree is that a violation of their rights? Like, how far can you go? And there are people who do treat their dogs like animals, and they'll not animals, like property, and they'll do all kinds of things. So sometimes training them in cruel ways, because they don't, dogs don't have feelings. We'll just do whatever we want. There's this thing where they train dogs to walk around on their hind legs all day. And there's a really cruel training process to get them to do that. But they see them as property. They breed dogs and they sell them, and they don't care about overpopulation. They don't care if they're going to good homes or not. They just treat them as property, which arguably is close to how human slaves were treated. So there's that. And yet that's all viewed with animals to be legal, because I guess government sees it as property. So I guess this goes back to the point about whether or not it is a right, or whether or not something is moral, whether or not the government and the rest of society recognizes it, is going to have a really big impact on you know, how that actually plays out in a real world situation.
That's very interesting. But yeah, I don't really have a well thought out argument. But so I'm instead just going to say that I would see that limits that the family can exercise authority over the dog would be if the dog had psychological reactions. So if it got scared or if it's got some kind of trauma, then it's probably excessive. It's probably too much. I get it can be debated, and I certainly do not know the answer. But as far as we can go, I think there is some kind of liberty that the dog had. Yeah,
it's also,
I think it should.
I'll say this one, because so I live in a place where there's a lot of dogs who are, they're not really stray dogs. They kind of like find their homes, but they're street dogs. They're out, they're free to go wherever they want. And I think what's really interesting is, so yeah, here's an example. One of my neighbors took one of these street dogs, brought him into his apartment, put him on a leash, gave him a bath, you know, he gets fed every day now, you know, so that there is that benefit relationship. But at no point did the dog ever say, hey, you know what, I decided I want to be an apartment dog. You know, he was taken, and maybe he didn't fight it that much. And that goes back to the, you know, maybe the scenario of a human who's being taken as a slave and just doesn't object to it and just goes along with it. You know, maybe there's that sort of scenario, but there's no explicit agreement. And when you go back to the common law of what is a contract is an explicit meeting of the minds. It's an agreement. And I think ideally that would be wonderful, but obviously dogs aren't capable of making those types of agreements. And as humans, we're not, you know, yes, like if a dog's crying out, like we can understand that it's in pain, or if, you know, if it's feeling certain things to an extent, but not always. That's not always easy to understand, because they speak a different language than we speak. So, you know, again, I think you have a very good point, but I think it's just really, it's a very muddy area where I don't think there are, or I don't think there ever will be, any concrete way to prove or disprove some of, you know, some certain things about what rights are or how they should be. I think we're going to constantly discover new things. Things are going to constantly change, but we're also going to be constantly fighting for what we believe is right against people who believe that that is not right.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm not really sure what to say, but mostly because I have quite a bad memory. But
no worries.
No, I think that this problem with the dogs will eventually be in some way resolved, because dogs, they are evolving, so eventually their intelligence will reach higher levels and they will be able to understand, or alternatively, we will be able to kind of uplift them to sapience. So, and then they would be able to claim full autonomy and full benefits of age. Until then, I think we should treat them, as I said, as kids. But you should be able to homestead them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got two dogs myself, and so I think about these things a lot, because, you know, ultimately, you know, I'm against, you know, all forms of animal cruelty, although I'm not a vegan. but it's and I think a lot of people are coming to that too. And I think as humans, we're kind of evolving to be more compassionate towards animals. I think you're right. Things are always changing, and whether or not it's an actual evolution of the dogs themselves becoming more intelligent, I think our evolving compassion is going to change things. But it's going to be the only change is, or what is it? The only constant is change.
Yeah. So I think I'll touch a bit on your example of the compliant slave. So you basically said that the slave is compliant to the king, and so he doesn't object. So I'm not sure if I misunderstood, but the question is, does he have self-ownership, or does he just not exercise it? Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, if he doesn't claim if he doesn't claim it, does he have it?
Yeah, I think he does have it, even if he doesn't claim it. If he doesn't claim it to understand it, because the burden of proof to the right to his body is itself lies within the king capturing him as a slave. So we in history we do face this problem of ignorance, and there is only really two ways to solve it, and it is through the right libertarian approach of intellectual revolution, where you basically educate people as much as you can. I think that's a bit unpragmatic, so I support the agorist solution, which is you invite them to the counter economy and you basically educate them once they're in. So once they have a cost to lose if they leave the counter economy, they will have more profit learning about philosophical truths than if they would be in some random guy living a normal life. So they will be more invested in it, and they will basically have to learn about libertarianism and about freedom.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that as a valuable way of doing it. I think, you know, ultimately there are a lot of people trying to, I'll just say, evolve humanity in a lot of different ways. And I don't think there's any right or wrong way. I think some people are going to do it in different ways. Some people who need to go through the process to learn these things are going to get more out of it going through a different process. They're only going to probably move forward at all in one process where they wouldn't at all in another process based on, you know, their own preferences and you know, what gets them interested in it. So, the system that you're describing where you create a I think you called it a counter economy, and you invite people to participate in that, I think that's really awesome. There's definitely a lot of groups doing that sort of thing. There are other groups where, you know, they don't really create that, but they just, you know, they're kind of the armchair philosophers. They'll get into groups and start talking about this stuff. And while it's not as actionable as creating a counter economy, I think it is sort of preparing people who maybe don't have the courage to, because when you're creating a counter economy, usually you're talking about something that's potentially illegal and potentially going to get somebody in trouble with the police.
Yeah.
And some people they're afraid of that. They don't want to deal with that, which is fine. So if you can at least educate them, then when the other people who are more willing to create that counter economy, once that starts to grow, then you have another group of people here who are, you know, they're ready to participate in that because they have been educated. They're just waiting for, you know, an opportunity where the government is going to back off, and it makes it a little bit easier for them to do that. And without the fear of being, you know, their door kicked down at 2 a.m. and getting shot. So I think there's value in both. And I think, you know, having so many people doing so many different things is ultimately going to help humanity move forward together.
Yes, you're definitely right. The intellectual revolution and counter economics do go hand in hand, and they benefit each other. I think you mentioned these people that are scared to death of doing anything illegal, and these are people with a very high perceived cost of entering the counter economy. And I think you solve it by simplifying existence in the counter economy. So as the counter economy grows bigger and bigger, it becomes easier and safer to participate in it, generally at least, because that, as the bigger the counter economy gets, the easier it is for it to set up its own malicious forces to fight back at eventual aggression. A lot of people do not know this, but millions, like up to 100 million Americans, are already in some way counter-economic, the overwhelming majority without even knowing it, because the Leviathan state of the American Union is just so big. And it has such a big tax code. It has just so many numerous laws that it's impossible to keep track of even like 10% of it, of even 1%. So there's like videos on the internet saying that you commit like 10 crimes a day. So, and as the state grows and we come into late statism, there will be more and more laws and more complicated tax codes, and it will basically increase the counter economy by necessity. And the more central planning the state has, the more control it has over the official economy, the more the counter economy is going to grow. For example, we have the prohibition. The state outlawed official alcohol. So you had a huge counter economy where you had a huge gangsters fighting the federal agency. They saw a huge profit in supplying the illegal goods, which was higher than the cost. So they defended the counter economy, basically.
Right. Yeah, and that's a very good point too, that these people who are kind of afraid to break the law might just wait for the more, I guess, the agorist communities to grow, where they can be a safer part of that. They can become a part of that more safely, knowing that others are going to protect them. I think that's a really great point.
Right, yeah, I think a lot of people in the US have at least minor contact with someone who illegally smoked pot, like that uncle, yep, or the veteran, or in some way participated in illegal activity and overlooked it, simply because they were their family. And it's an exponential curve, so the more people get involved, the higher the rate grows, because of families and friends and all of that. Of course, there are going to be these die-hard loyalists, but in the end, even they will be counter-economists. Like you have state officials going to be corrupt is the most obvious example. Even in such a huge state as the monarchist North Korea, you had like this corruption where you had like generals and state officials trading with candy, and they gave out this like candy bars. The state gave out candy bars as a reward to this. So you had like a currency, and they were trading it. And the Korean state noticed it, and the South Korean state put like this candy on balloons, and they push the balloons into across the border. So all kinds of wonderful things happen in the counter economy. And another fun example I have is actually from the Soviet part of my family. They had this time in the Soviet Union, which was effectively a prohibition, where the state basically limited you to buying vodka. So they created a huge scarcity of vodka. And you had like the state handing out vodka to people. Or I don't know the details, but you had like huge scarcity. And people who didn't consume vodka had a lot of it. So what they started doing is they started giving vodka to drunks who had special talents. And so I give you a quarter of a vodka bottle and you come and fix my sink. So you had like this huge counter economy, and it continued for 4 years or 5 years, I think, until the state realized it and lifted this heavy regulation. So
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, there's a lot of people too who are, you know, not quite willing to act yet, but no, I mean, you know, there's anybody who pays income tax in the United States, they do whatever they can to reduce that. They know that, you know, nobody's going to sit and say, you know, oh, I'm just going to pay the maximum because that's fine. Everybody tries to, they just want to do it the legal way. They don't want to get into trouble for it. But a lot of people are still willing to say, oh, well, that's my kid, right? They make up kids as their deductions to try and make, save a few more bucks on the return. So, it's definitely interesting, but I think ultimately, you know, we have these situations like you talked about where they try a prohibition and it doesn't work. And then, so they have to change it. Ultimately, that's, they're fixing it because they've learned something, but they haven't learned the right thing. And the right thing is about what is right. And then it wasn't right to implement these prohibitions in the first place. And so that's why I think it's so important to educate the principles, the core principles, or as you called it, the primary, principles,
the first principle.
Once you understand these, you don't make those mistakes anymore. And you really start to respect other people and things, you know, we'll be able to move forward so fast as a society, as humanity, when we don't keep running into these roadblocks where we keep shutting each other down, in these really bad attempts to fix problems. So we're at the end of the show, but I want to give you an opportunity. You know, just if you have any final words, you want to say, or, if there's any interesting projects you're working on that you want to talk about.
Originally I wanted to make an argument for why so-called political libertarianism is unlibertarian. I guess we didn't really have the time for full discussion, but I will make as good of an argument as I can. So we have established self-ownership, and from that follows that taxation is theft because it's a violation of property rights.
I like that.
Yeah. So basically the state and any rulers, all of the rulers claim the right to authority. That being the right to rule. And just like atheism, anarchism claims that there is no such thing as the right to rule. It cannot be proven. Therefore, anarchism is true. And statism and rulerism is false until it can be proven true. And historically, it has only been true. The followers of statism, the state theists, have tried to prove rulerism true by appealing to gods or special pleading. And they have been highly inconsistent with their principles. So if the king has a right to rule, why do I not have a right to rule? Why can I not be king? why does the king, the official king, have a monopoly on being king? And they will say, those in favor of democracy will say, well, we gave them that right. Well, do I have the right to act as a president? Do I have the right to go to create a trade war with China, tweet about tweet all day, and collect all of these taxes? Well, no, only the president has that right. But how did we give him that right? If we don't have that right ourselves, how did we give it to the president? And an excellent book I would recommend on this topic is The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose. It's an excellent book. I listened to it this summer, and basically debunks most claims to legitimacy of the right to rule. And so you've been running as a presidential candidate, and now you're running as a candidate for Senator of Texas, I believe.
Governor of Texas, yep.
And so, yeah, I see. And that would be exercising a non-existent right to rule. I've checked a bit of your policies, which, if I recall, you said you would be replacing police with constitutional guardians or something, and cutting tax and the regulation. I'm not sure, though. I think it's a honorable goal. But I think it's ineffective and unprincipled. I think it goes against libertarian principles. And I think it's highly inconsistent. So when you're trying to reduce the size of government using the government, you face the problem of using politicians to end politics, the use of bureaucrats to end bureaucracy, using taxmen to end taxes. I think that's a very important thing. So historically, the only time we've been able to reduce the size of government has been through violence. Either you go set up a guillotine square and a new flag, or some tea in the hand tells the Brits to fuck off. But we haven't really seen a huge shift or reduction in power of the ruling class using peaceful means or political means for that matter. And the third problem I see is actually an objection to purist libertarianism. And so-called political libertarians, or as I like to call them, liberals, said that you will never be able to spread libertarianism if you're going through the strict definition of libertarianism, if you reject the common definition. And the problem with that is that you associate libertarianism with its arch enemy, which is politics. And you basically integrate it into politics. So you can't really have an anarchist party. And by the way, the Libertarian Party promised to not be political when it was founded. My source for this is Conkin, one of his books. I don't remember which one it is, but so you get like this result that socialist face. You know, if you look at socialist theory, socialism is basically workers' ownership of meat production. A lot of the things vary with the authors, but because of Marxism and because of the Soviet Union, socialism is now heavily associated with huge states and huge governments. So now, and especially in America, socialism has become an anti-concept. which is basically a rationally unused term. You know, Republicans will call the Democrat version of their economy, economics, socialism. They will call Medicare socialism. And Democrats will go say that, I don't know what they're saying, but they will go say that that other thing is socialism. And the guys that follow the Italian ideology from the 30s will say that being a so-called degenerate is socialism. And so you get this problem. If we do not, if we do associate libertarianism with politics, it becomes an anti-concept. So if you're going to use government to try to reduce government, you should use the old term for it, which is liberalism, which is basically small government. Or you could use minarchism, which was invented by Samuel Edward Konkin to call out states. I think that's all I have to say for now.
All right. Well, let's do this because those are some really good points. I'm going to respond to those and I'll give you an opportunity to get the last word in before we wrap the show up. A couple of things that I think are really important. I mean, you make like these are really good points. But I think, and you know, to use your own words earlier, I think you said, I don't remember what you were talking about when you said it is not an agent because it cannot do something itself. In that way, government is not an agent. It has people who participate in what it does, and those people are agents. Because
yes, they actually... a government would be, I would recognize government as a legal entity, which right. is basically you're trying to create a agent in the legal sense, but it's not an agent in the philosophical sense.
Right. Well, let's think about it in the philosophical sense, because you have this thing called government, okay. and you've got you know, it's got hundreds of thousands of employees. Government itself is nothing. It's just a thing on the shelf. And to call something a legal entity is like, okay, yeah, that just means when you get into the courtroom, a government courtroom, that just means the rules are going to play out a little bit differently because it's a different legal entity. But at the end of the day, let's say I do get elected as governor. And let's say as governor, I have, you know, 10,000 people who work at different levels underneath me. They all work for me. At this point, those people are already employed and they're doing things which I would consider immoral, which I'm sure you would consider immoral. If I were to get elected and get into this position, if I never did anything that was immoral and I ordered all the people who worked for me never to do anything that was immoral and they followed those orders, they didn't do anything immoral, or if they did do something immoral, they were properly, you know, fired or you know, whatever we do to them, would that be a violation of somebody's rights? So when you talk about, and I totally love that book, Larkin Rose, very, very excellent points, you know, what he says about the Constitution and the, you know, the Constitution being an illegitimate document, because the people who wrote it gave rights to government that they didn't have rights to give. I completely agree with that. At the same time, you know, going back to some of these things we talked about where, yeah, that's fine. And we can continue to educate people, but that's only going to get us so far so fast, because at the end of the day, we don't have, you know, even if all of us anarchists and agorists and libertarians and everybody else pulled all of our money together, we wouldn't be able to get as much airtime as the Democrat and Republicans get with their propaganda. Which is basically, if you look at this as a war of knowledge or a war of education, we cannot outpace what these people are doing. And of course, they have all that money to do that because that money comes from people who want to control other people so that they can turn back around and get profits out of it. So they spend money on propaganda and they pull that back in profits out of us and our labor. So ultimately, what is the best way to get out and educate so many people? And I argue that one of these best ways is to get into the political arena and start saying some of the things that wake people up to these rights. So for here's a really interesting example. Cannabis legalization. A lot of people in the political realm will say cannabis is good for it's good for agriculture, it's good for small businesses, it's good for health, it can be used as medicines, it's got all these wonderful benefits, and therefore we should make it legal. I get in there and say it never should have been illegal because the government has no right to make it legal. It doesn't matter if there are no benefits for it. Cocaine doesn't have as many benefits. Heroin has even fewer benefits. Those should be legal as well, only because the government has no right to take those away from you. Now, another position to take on, now this is something that's getting potentially in front of more people who are already listening to the billion-dollar political conversation and hijacking that political conversation. Of course, that's a struggle, it's not easy, but hijacking that political conversation and injecting these other ideas. So, and I've said this before, ultimately my goal is, and I'm very careful with the way that I say this, because if I say my goal is not to win, then people say, oh, well, it's not a real campaign, he's not really trying to win. People want to get behind that. This goes back to our emotional need to, like, you know, get behind something and cheer it on and be a part of some big change. People want that. But at the same time, if we're going to use that as an influence for real change that's waking people up with real knowledge and fighting against this old way of, you know, yeah, the government controls everything that we do, that's something absolutely more substantial. And ultimately, the way I see it is somebody with my political platform is never going to win until the people themselves start to think in this way and rejecting the idea that government should have so much power. And that's kind of how I see the difference between, I mean, yes, you have the minarchists, I think you called them liberals, who would basically, or classical liberals, because in the US, a liberal is totally something else. Classical liberals who would say, you know, and there's plenty of them in the Libertarian Party who they don't believe taxation is theft. They say, well, yeah, we should have a very, very small government, but we don't need to get rid of it completely. I mean, they build wonderful roads. You've got plenty of those people. And that's fine. But ultimately, if you're not saying that taxation is theft, you're still agreeing that the government has some right to take these things away from you. Now, here's another interesting argument that I like to use all the time, and that's, if you have the government, right, and you know, a lot of anarchists will say the government is inherently evil, government equals the use of force, it is the use of force, it is criminal, it is a criminal organization, all these other things. That's what it is now. Let's say you, hypothetically, you have the government and what it is now and all of the crimes that it does, but the government is not a thing, it's just a bunch of people doing a bunch of things. If you were to take this government and through whatever means it took, you were to change this government so that it didn't violate anybody's rights, it didn't steal from anybody, it didn't murder anybody, it didn't assume to have rights that it wasn't delegated by people who didn't have them. If all of that was true, what would the government be? And some people would say, well, that wouldn't be government because government is rulership and it's this and that, you know. But this goes back to our question about definitions. If that is an acceptable organization to exist because it's not violating people's rights, it's not ruling over people, it's, you know, I don't know what it might be doing. It might still be selling stamps and delivering mail. It might be doing some things, very, very much less than what it's doing now, but it's doing something. And it's raising money through completely voluntary means. What would you call that? And if somebody wants to call that, yeah, that's my government, and those are the only people in the way of making this happen, do you really want to fight with them? Or do you really want to get them to just say, like, okay, yeah, that's government. I'm fine if the government doesn't steal from people. And to you, that's not a government, but to them, it's still a government. Yeah, ultimately, we still want to educate them on, you know, the idea, this idea of rights and whether or not government has the authority to do things. But if they can agree on that, but they're not comfortable living in a world without government, Wouldn't you just let them have that kind of neutered government, that government that doesn't have the this supposed authority to violate people's rights? And so I think, you know, all the points that you made are very valid, and I can't really say that you're wrong. But I do, I guess the only one that I disagree with is that, is to say that what I'm doing is either in some way ineffective or in some way immoral, because ultimately, if I get elected, there's only two things I can do: the things that I do myself and the things that I order other people to do for me. And if I myself, regardless of what people believe about the government and regardless of what the government has the authority to do or what I can legally get away with without courts and legislators and other people getting in my way, if I don't do anything immoral, and if the people who are following my orders aren't given any immoral orders, is that really such a bad thing?
Yeah, okay. So that was very interesting response. I can't really say I expected such a response, but okay, let's accept the premise that you can change government with the use of government and that you're running. I think the first thing you should do is disassociate yourself from anarchism and libertarianism in general, and rename your platform, if you will, to at least classical liberalism or minarchism or something like that, so that libertarianism doesn't become an anti-concept. Because Ron Paul has done a lot of good things in the name of liberalism. He has gotten a lot of Republicans and Democrats over. He has created a third option from the paradigm. And he really put a dagger in the heel of the two-party state. The big problem that was with him, now you've got like all of these people, like millions of people calling themselves libertarian. I saw a figure somewhere, I don't remember where, and it should not be taken as a legitimate source, but I saw a figure that said that like 40 million people associate themselves with libertarianism in the US. And so now I've got two people on Instagram that blocked me after I said that Ron Paul has created more bad things for the libertarian movement by associating libertarianism with the state. So you get like these people that really love Ron Paul, and they think that libertarianism is like the tree which has all these flowers under it, which is liberalism, minarchism, and anarchism. So you get like a generation of anti-intellectuals, I believe, and libertarianism really loses its meaning. So, but if you live past that and you get elected, the first thing you would do if you have libertarian principle is, one, resign, because as the government is running now, it violates every single libertarian principle. The second thing you could do is radically transform the government, as you were talking about, which is abolish taxation and abolish all laws and all of this, and just provide the services with taking in the voluntary funds. But as you predicted, I would say that's not the government, that's a private corporation with some form of democracy. You would have like these private firms and individuals competing with the government, providing services from the free market. And I think that as a rule, the free market is much more effective than any form of government, and that smaller units in the market are much more effective than bigger units, so like cooperatives and entrepreneurs are in the end much more successful than big corporations like Apple. And so I would argue because of a short time preference, we would have increasingly smaller and smaller unit of economic organization until we reached like full self-employment, where everyone would be self-employed and there would be no hierarchy of the workplace. So basically a socialist wet dream. And you were talking about moving the Overton window, which I think is quite interesting. And I'm not, I think it's much easier to convert liberals than it is to convert libertarians. And I think it might be better to create liberals and be successful. On the other hand, if you grow the state to totalitarian levels, you get a huge country economy and they associate from there, as I talked about earlier, and you could go that way instead too. Yeah, I think that's my response. I don't know if I missed something.
All right. Well, no, those are great points, and I wish I could respond to all those, but I did say I'd give you the last word before we wrap this up. There's just one that I want to throw out there, and that's, you know, you said if I did get elected, the first thing I would have to do is resign, and that's a very interesting one. I know that was Adam Kokesh's presidential campaign plan, but I do want to point out that if let's say there's a tank and it's driving through town and it's running people over and it's crashing into buildings and it's driving over cars and it's causing damage, and I'm running an election to become the driver of that tank, you could easily say that tank is evil. It's going around, it's destroying lives, it's killing people, it's crushing property. That tank is evil and we need to get rid of that tank. But you can't. What are you going to do? Stand in front of it? You can't. But they have an election to elect who's going to be the driver of that tank. Now, let's say I get elected to become the driver of that tank. And under that premise, the tank is obviously an analogy for the government. Under that premise, I get into the tank. Your argument to resign is that I need to immediately jump out of the tank while it's still moving. And the tank's going to continue running over people. It's going to continue crashing into things and everything else. But if I'm in the tank, if I stay in the tank, that's where the brake pedal is. So I can actually stop the tank from inside. And I know the argument has been made, oh yeah, politics have always been tried to change from inside and it never works. And you're right, it never really works, because most of the people who get elected, they get elected the easiest way they can, which is to do whatever they need to do to win the votes. And what I'm doing different, and what I think a lot of other libertarians are doing, is we're sticking to our principles. We're risking we're giving up the easy win by going for the hard win, where we're only going to win when people accept the principles and policies that we're saying, so that when we do get in there, we can step on the brakes. Because ultimately, especially as governor, you have the right, you have the authority, the power. I don't even know what the right word to use is for that. The ability to step on the brakes. Except for the shadow government, of course, but that's another story. But I think that is very powerful. But like I said before, in order to win, you change all the minds. And even if you don't win, if you change all those minds are now going to put all that pressure on whoever does win, whoever's in office, in all the different offices, to say, back off of our rights, stop violating our rights, stop stealing from us, and stop killing us. So I'm sure you have a response for that, but we really are going over on the show. I'd love to have you back sometime and continue this conversation. I think it's really been amazing. But for anybody listening, if you like this show, please make sure to share and comment and like and retweet and do all that fun stuff. And of course, this is going to be broadcast as a podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast, make sure you subscribe. And if you're not listening to the podcast, make sure you go to find it. It's on all the places where you find your favorite podcasts, on iTunes and Google and Podbean and all those other places. Go check it out. Make sure you subscribe and listen to all of our episodes. And of course, head on over to taxationistheft.info, where you can find out more about the podcast and support us by buying all of our really awesome swag. Tavarish Agarist, thank you again so much for joining me. I hope to have you back on soon. And we'll see you next time. Taxation is Theft.